So cystic fibrosis is a genetic disease. It's an autosomal recessive genetic disease. So that means that it is not sex-related, and it's recessive in the sense that if you get a mutation in the cystic fibrosis gene, just one of them, because you got two copies of every gene, right? One from your mother, one from your father. If you get a mutation in one of those copies of that gene, you will not have the disease. That's recessive. If it were dominant, you just need a single copy and you'd have the disease. Huntington's disease, for example, is a case of that. So it's an autosomal recessive disease. It's a single gene. And the CF gene codes for a protein called the cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulator. And we call it CFTR for short, for obvious reasons, right? CFTR. When you have the disease, so when you've got two defective genes, you don't have a functional protein. And that's what leads to all of the symptoms. That's what leads to the etiology of the disease.
Hey, welcome back. In order to understand where we're going, where I'm going, we need to understand a bit more about CF and how we got here. And in order to do that, we have to put on our science hat. Now, let's be clear. I don't own a science hat. I am a theater school dropout. Luckily, though, we've got some pretty smart folks to lean on in that category. So here's an effort to put a lot of the things that always baffled me about CF into a tidy little package for you and for me to finally understand. This is Breathless, a podcast from Cystic Fibrosis Canada and Snack Labs exploring the shifting landscape of cystic fibrosis, the most common fatal genetic disease among people in Canada. In May 1989, the Calgary Flames beat the Montreal Canadiens to win their first Stanley Cup. Protests were spreading in Tiananmen Square. Madonna's Like a Prayer was topping the charts. And at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, the defective gene that causes cystic fibrosis, CFTR, was discovered by Dr. Lap Chi Choi. The science was funded by Cystic Fibrosis Canada and in collaboration with Dr. Francis Collins at the University of Michigan. Dr. Collins lent his expertise in pioneering a method of mapping genomes called chromosome jumping, a method that enabled much faster mapping than its predecessor, aptly named chromosome walking. To put it into perspective, at this point in time, we were still 14 years away from successfully mapping the human genome, a project that took 13 years and $3 billion to complete, what we can do now for a couple of $100 by just spitting into a tube and waiting a couple of weeks. The magnitude of this discovery is difficult to overstate. Dr. Lap Chi Choi went on to be made an officer of the Order of Canada, became the president of the University of Hong Kong, and was inducted into the Canadian Medical Hall of Fame in 2012. Dr. Francis Collins also made significant contributions to isolating the gene responsible for Huntington's disease. He was appointed as the director of the National Center for Human Genome Research, leading the team that successfully carried out the Human Genome Project, changing the course of medicine and genetics forever. Oh, and he also served under three presidents as the director of the National Institute of Health from 2009 to 2021. Not a shabby career. Remember Paul Eckford from episode one? Well, before Paul, there was John.
Okay, so I'm John Wallenberg. I am the retired now chief scientific officer at Cystic Fibrosis Canada. I'm a PhD scientist. My PhD is in genetic engineering.
I like to think of Paul and John as the apostles, spreading the gospel and good news of cystic fibrosis. I also like to point out the fact that this is not accurate whatsoever. I digress. Where were we? Oh, right. The discovery of the CFTR mutation.
Right. So when they were looking for the CF gene, the way they were going to identify it was by recognizing the difference between the gene in normal people and the gene in someone who has the disease. Because they were doing it through something called positional cloning. So the only way they were actually going to recognize that they found the gene was by having a difference between what was normal and somebody with the disease. And so what they did is that's what identified this as being the cystic fibrosis gene, is because they found that little deletion, those that one amino acid that was missing.
What did it mean for the CF community when the F508del gene was first identified?
Oh, Lordy, it was huge. And it was huge for a whole bunch of reasons. One, the fact that they were able to clone the gene, find the gene. Remember, this was the first time that any gene was found by positional cloning alone in the world, in the history of science. And there have been a whole bunch of different firsts in cystic fibrosis. But I don't know. How do you describe that? In terms of a scientific breakthrough, you know, you've got, you're looking for one particular blade of straw in a haystack, right? And it's not, you're not looking for a needle in a haystack. You're looking for one particular blade of straw in a haystack. And you do it through positional cloning.
When CFTR was discovered, it seemed like the cure for CF would follow quickly after.
And so that was huge. But the other thing was, because it's a single gene, there was this huge belief, myself included, that it was going to be relatively simple to do some form of genetic type therapy to cure the disease. I think we didn't fully understand the complexity of the biology behind cystic fibrosis before we cloned the gene.
For more on that, here's Brother Paul.
So the gene was discovered at SickKids in 1989, basically. The most common mutation was identified at that time, and people said, "Well, this is it. We've done it. Now we just have to produce a cure to this, and we're done." And even before the gene was discovered, during the time where we were, as an organization, were helping to fund that effort, the organization's message was, once we know the gene, it's basically done. We've figured it out. Then we just have to have a cure for it. That's so easy once we've discovered the gene. So I think that everybody was expecting that the therapy would follow soon after.
Like Paul said, we were expecting things to happen like that. But like most everything in science, things were a bit more complicated than originally thought.
People weren't expecting that it was going to be, you know, like 30 years until we had Trikafta, a therapy that can help the majority with CF.
There was a sense in the scientific community that discovering the CFTR gene was most of the heavy lifting that needed to be done in order to find a cure for cystic fibrosis. Although this was ultimately far from the reality of the situation, it certainly laid a significant foundation for the progress to come over the next three decades. An incredibly important part of the discovery of the CFTR gene was the discovery of a particular mutation of this gene, which is present in close to 90% of CF patients in Canada. This mutation causes a deletion of phenylalanine 508, and it's referred to as F508del.
So the most common mutation is the deletion of phenylalanine 508 in the protein. So it's basically just a deletion of amino acid there.
Phenylalanine is an amino acid, which is an essential building block of proteins, which serve all sorts of functions throughout our bodies. When the CFTR gene has an F508del mutation, it means a very specific protein is built with a small but extremely important defect.
And that causes the protein to not fold properly into the shape it's supposed to be. So you can think about it, when a protein is made, it's made from the instructions from the DNA, and it's this long strand of amino acids. They then sort of fold up. You can kind of think about it like origami. And so it folds into a specific shape. And a lot of the way the protein works is based on its specific shape.
So it's a single amino acid out of 1,480. So you might think, well, geez, that's not much. If you had a whole Lego construction of 1,480 and you kind of went, well, we're missing number 580, it's going to look pretty much the same. But what it does is it leads to a misfolding in the protein.
The domains don't come together properly, and the quality control processes in the cell say, wait a minute, this doesn't look right. And instead of sending it to the cell surface where it should function, it just gets degraded.
So there's very, very, very little F508del that makes it to the surface of the cell.
This happens to be the mutation of the CFTR gene that I have. This is an error that is happening at an infinitesimally small scale, but producing gigantic, life-altering consequences in everyday life. Cystic fibrosis is a disease that affects multiple organs throughout the body.
Science!
Okay, science hat time. Let's think of the CFTR gene like a window on the wall of your cells. The window's purpose is to open and close, which provides space for chloride ions to move in and out of the cell. Now, along with chloride ions, you find water. When the CFTR gene has this mutation, it prevents that window from opening and closing properly, so the chloride ions can't do their job. CFTR expresses itself in organs that produce mucus. And when there isn't enough water moving in and out of the cell, that mucus becomes really thick and extremely sticky, which leads to many, many problems within the body. And it's not just the lungs. My whole life, I've often described CF as a lung disease, and in many very important ways, that's true. But take the digestive system, for example. I would guess, with a fairly high degree of certainty, that you've probably lived close to 100% of all the days you've been alive with a great deal of confidence that when you put food in your mouth, it will make its way down into your stomach and give you all the fuel and energy you need to go about your daily activities. In fact, I would bet that your confidence in this particular body function is so high that your thoughts about food end abruptly at the threshold of your lips. What most people don't know about CF is how it affects the pancreas. The pancreas has these tiny little ducts that get plugged with this thick mucus, and they stop working altogether. This prevents my body from producing the enzymes required for digestion. The mucus within the lining of my intestines impacts the way my body absorbs nutrients from the food that I eat. If you have CF today, or you know someone with CF, you've probably been worried about their lung function and how it gets progressively worse over time. If you were born many decades ago, you likely wouldn't have lived long enough to worry about your lungs getting worse. Why is that, you ask? Well, if your body can't absorb nutrients from the food that you eat during the digestion process, you will die. And you will die rather quickly. We've been humming along with a lot of the science behind cystic fibrosis, and we certainly haven't come to the end of that road, but I'd like to take a little detour and introduce you to someone who has defied the odds from the day she was born.
Hi, my name is Lorna McEwen. I live in Tisdale, Saskatchewan. I am a cystic fibrosis advocate. And I have cystic fibrosis, and I am the ripe old age of 63 years and a few months. I am the oldest living cystic fibrosis patient diagnosed in Saskatchewan from birth. The life expectancy when I was born was not very good. You were lucky if you made it in your first year or if you made it to the age of four.
In 1960, the understanding of cystic fibrosis was a very different picture from what it looks like today. The types of treatments that allowed me to live to be a 10-year-old boy, finding a pamphlet that said I would be lucky to live to be 30, they didn't exist yet. And cystic fibrosis, from the perspective of any medical professional at the time, was as good as a signed death certificate, postdated between 6 months and 10 years. When Lorna was born, exogenous digestive enzymes, meaning enzymes that someone could consume rather than the ones created by our bodies, had only been invented just over 10 years earlier. And even then, their efficacy was significantly less than what we can expect from oral enzymes today. And let's take a look at bacteria. Although the bacterial protection properties of mold had been observed for centuries, readily available antibiotics did not come about until after 1929, when Dr. Alexander Fleming, a Scottish physician, formally cultured a substance called mold juice. Ew. So Alexander Fleming struck gold with mold juice, which he upgraded to the much fancier name, penicillin. It's all about branding, isn't it? Imagine asking your doctor, could I get a prescription for some mold juice, please? Not quite the medical marvel it sounds like it is today. Penicillin definitely rolls off the tongue better, and let's be honest, it sounds a lot less like something you scraped off last week's bread. Antibiotics to treat some of the bacterial threats posed to people born with CF, like Cepatia and Pseudomonas, were not available until the late 1950s. Thanks to the advances in antibiotic treatment and digestive enzymes, someone like Lorna, born in 1960, was one of the first of a new generation of cystic fibrosis patients who enjoyed a significant advantage over everyone else in history who was born with a defective CFTR gene. However, in a time before our current technology and rapid communication, which accelerates scientific research and discovery, the prognosis for someone born with cystic fibrosis remained incredibly bleak.
Basically, when I was born, Mom and Dad filled me in on the details. I had lost a brother previously in 1954. He, at the age of 2 weeks, sounded like he had pneumonia really bad, and they lost him. And then when I came along, there was this kid that was born dead. They revived me. And then within 24 hours, I had to have 18 inches of my small intestine removed because of meconium ileus. And basically, I was in hospital for about 307 days because my bowels ended up in the diaper. So they put me back in until the rest of the 307 days was served. And Mom and Dad, they couldn't say the word cystic fibrosis. It came out, they didn't have a clue, like 65 roses. And the doctors basically, after a year, basically said, you know what? Take her home, love her, done what we can do. They had no hope for the parents. And like, Mom and Dad had a lot of hope.
Perhaps you're listening to this and you have children. Perhaps you don't. Perhaps you see children in your future. Perhaps you don't. Whatever the case may be, I'd like you to take a moment and envision a life where you bring a child into this world. And when they enter, the intense joy that typically accompanies this experience is replaced by sorrow and an overwhelming sense of injustice. You are told that your child has something wrong with them, something that will take that child away from you almost as quickly as they came.
I remember that day so well.
If you don't remember, that's my mom.
I was downstairs playing with you, and your dad had gotten a phone call from the pediatrician telling us that you were positive for cystic fibrosis.
Can you describe the, your initial reaction and how you handled that news?
I didn't handle it very well at all. I was 15 weeks pregnant, and I just lost it. I just cried, and I think I cried for 3 weeks straight, I think, when I found out that you had it. And then, like, right away, I just wanted to know, like, what I could do to prevent you from, you know, getting worse or dying or, you know, just try to... It was almost like you lose, like, this control to feel like, oh, my God, like, what do you do? How do I fix this? And I couldn't fix it. When you got diagnosed and they said, like, he'd be lucky to see his 20th birthday. When you first got diagnosed, I was just so devastated and upset and thinking, like, how am I going to do this? You know, I'm pregnant with another baby and my son at 21 months old is, you know, diagnosed with this chronic illness. And I just, like, had the hardest time trying to put my head around, like, how does this happen? They said that it was a severe lung disease, that there was no cure, and you would be lucky if he lived to see his 20th birthday or to attend university.
Now, imagine being told that your child is actually one of the lucky ones. That they just so happened to be born just after the advent of crucial medicines that might give you 5 years? 10 years? Instead of the 6 to 12 months that parents could expect a decade or so earlier. To the parents of someone born with cystic fibrosis in 1960, this is exactly the type of thing you might have heard. And as you can imagine, it would be no consolation. For a parent, anything less than a long and healthy life is simply unacceptable. And have no doubt that some of the most incredible leaps and bounds that have been made in treating any number of diseases, especially ones that primarily affect children, do not simply arise from the scientific or academic curiosities of doctors and researchers. Rather, they arise from the refusal of courageous parents. The refusal to stand idly by while their children are slowly lost to disease, and the relentless pursuit of advocating for healthcare policies, access to new medications, and development of new medical technologies that will slowly and incrementally improve the quality of life for their children and all the children that will be born with the same terrible disease.
My dad is Frank Lear. Him and my mom, Barbara, they were amazing heroes in my world. Dad was a huge advocate for, and mom were both huge advocates for cystic fibrosis. You can talk about the one, but the other one is a main part of that one too. And mom has passed a year ago now. And but dad is still going strong at the age of 99. And they were involved with CF Canada, basically, from the moment I became born, they started looking around and found out about it and got involved, heavily involved. And because they were busy looking for answers and questions on what to do with this kid in their house that they got no clue what to do with, and a support group and all that, because there wasn't really any support groups out in the West. And they were part of the key instrumental people that put a CF chapter in Saskatchewan.
Cystic Fibrosis Canada plays an enormously important role in our story. Don't worry, I haven't forgotten about the cliffhanger we left you on at the end of the last episode, and we're making our way there, I promise you. But for now, let us briefly return to 1989. If you recall, the groundbreaking discovery of the CFTR gene was made by research. Research funded by Cystic Fibrosis Canada. And Cystic Fibrosis Canada can fund research like this because of the parents and siblings and partners and friends who love someone who lives with cystic fibrosis. I could not possibly overstate, even if my life depended on it, and as it happens, it does, the importance of the voice of people who have refused to give up throughout decades of heartache, giving people like me a fighting chance by creating and supporting an organization that does the work that Cystic Fibrosis Canada has done for me and thousands of others across this country. Okay, detour over. Let's jump back onto the science track. The CFTR gene is discovered in 1989, and along with it, the most common mutation of that gene, F508del, the mutation that I and almost 90% of people with CF in Canada are born with. But by 1992, 150 other mutations had been discovered. And as you listen to this today, we are aware of over 2,000 different mutations of cystic fibrosis that someone could be born with, and each one will change the way that CF affects them.
There are many different types of mutations. There have been over 2,000 mutations described for the CF gene, and as you can imagine, those mutations can have lots of different impacts. It could be anything from being sort of a silent mutation where there's no real impact. It's been described because it's been found, but those people don't really exhibit characteristics of CF. All the way to mutations so severe, you get absolutely no protein made at all. And we classify mutations into, you know, about 5 to 7 different categories based on what the mutation does to the protein. And largely that sort of dictates how healthy the person with CF is. So we have these mutations that are called nonsense mutations. And if you have one of those, basically anything after that point when it's made in the protein is just garbage and it doesn't get completely made. So there are a variety of different CF mutations where people have a very short or almost non-existent CFTR protein. There are also mutations that cause chunks of the protein to be missing, but you still get sort of the beginning and the end of it. There are mutations where maybe one amino acid is changed, and that change in amino acid can impact how the protein gets out to the cell surface and how it functions there.
These mutations don't just change the way that CF can affect someone, but it also affects the way their CF is treated. Science is a progressive, iterative process. One discovery builds upon another and informs the research to unearth yet another. We can treat the discovery of the CFTR gene as the first domino to fall in a cascade of events that would unravel over the next 30 years, bringing about treatments that were once the stuff of science fiction novels and Star Trek episodes.
So people first started talking about modulator therapies at some point after the year 2000, so sort of the mid 2000s, people realized that if you take cells with the most common mutation, Delta 508, and you grow them at a cooler temperature, so 27 degrees rather than the usual body temperature of 37 degrees, you could get CFTR function in these cells. But at 37 degrees, you couldn't. And so people realized that you could get the protein to get out to the cell surface and work if you intervened. Obviously, we can't put people in fridges and keep them at 27 degrees. You wouldn't survive. But it was a good indicator that if you had the right intervention, you could make the protein work. And so then the search was on for, okay, can we do that with a molecule rather than changing the temperature?
In the year 2000, after the Y2K scare was firmly behind us, of course, a company called Aurora Biosciences began work on a drug development for CF. A year later, Aurora was acquired by a much larger company called Vertex Pharmaceuticals. And in 2005, for the first time in over 15 years, another major event rippled through the CF and scientific world. A new form of treatment was starting development at Vertex, and it was showing promise as something that could revolutionize the treatment and quality of life for CF patients. It's called a gene modulator, and it's the big one.
I did my PhD at the University of Guelph, studying a protein that's involved in multi-drug resistance in cancer. But by the end of it, I thought, well, it's still kind of a so what thing, because we didn't impact those patients that were challenged with drug-resistant cancers. So then when I was looking for a postdoc, I thought, well, maybe I can take the skills that I've learned studying membrane proteins and their function and apply it somewhere where I could have more of an impact. So I moved to the Research Institute at SickKids, working with Christine Baer, who was very interested in understanding the structure and function of the CFTR protein. And some of the work that I did there was developing assays to understand in the lab how the CFTR protein works, how the channel opens and closes, and how that's changed in the presence of small molecules. And one of the small molecules that we studied became the drug ivacaftor, or Kalydeco.
The first gene modulator was a drug called ivacaftor, and its brand name was Kalydeco. The drug was marketed in 2012, and although this was a game-changing treatment for CF, it had one major flaw.
The company that ultimately marketed the first modulator was hard at work on getting one of those small molecules that did check all those boxes, that it wasn't toxic, that it was highly effective, that it could be administered in people.
This drug, called Kalydeco, is really effective for certain types of cystic fibrosis mutations. Think about it this way. Imagine the protein in your body is like a construction worker, just trying to do his job. And the cell surface is where the work site this handyman needs to be. For some mutations, like the G551D, the construction worker can get to the work site, the cell surface, but he can't quite do the job properly. Kalydeco provides him with the tools necessary to do his job. But for the most common mutation, F508del, the problem is like the construction worker doesn't even have the ability to reach the job site on the cell surface, and Kalydeco is no help in this case. Although Kalydeco could only treat a small proportion of those with CF, it flipped the trajectory of CF treatment on its head by not just treating a symptom, like the clearing of airways and dislodging the thick, sticky mucus, but by going deeper, down to the molecular level, treating cystic fibrosis at the source. I remember when I first heard about Kalydeco, and to be honest, I couldn't really wrap my head around it. I understood that it could be helpful, but I think my mind, knowing I couldn't take this drug, was trying to protect me from understanding its potential. Perhaps realizing that Kalydeco could save the life of someone with CF, but not me with CF, was too much. When you live with a genetic illness that can kill you, hope can sometimes feel like a dangerous state of mind to occupy. I've often felt like hope is something that will inevitably inflict its cruelty when the promise it proposes never comes. And so I remained steadfast in my belief that my life would carry on towards the end of the tracks, as previously defined by researchers and doctors the world over. Hope just felt like a luxury I couldn't afford. I know I was a bit of a bummer just then, but I'm just being honest with you. I know Kalydeco got a lot of people very excited, and for good reason. Although hopeful might not be a word I would have used to describe myself at the time, there was certainly no shortage of scientists, researchers, and advocates who recognized the importance and potential of Kalydeco. In 2015, we took another big step. After Kalydeco, Vertex took direct aim at the F508del mutation. And although a new drug called Lumacaftor failed clinical trials, researchers noticed that when they combined it with ivacaftor, they started to see a response in patients with two copies of F508del. Here's how. This protein issue we've talked about. In people who are approved to take Kalydeco, their mutation makes it so that the protein can get out to the surface of the cell, but it doesn't really work when it gets there. So that's the piece that Kalydeco does. It makes the protein work once it arrives at its destination. If you have the F508del mutation, The protein can't get out to the cell surface, and that's where this new drug, Lumacaftor, comes in. It helps deliver the protein to its destination, but doesn't help it work once it gets there. On their own, the two treatments, again, we're talking about Lumacaftor and Ivacaftor, are either useless or only suitable for a very small amount of people. But when the two join forces, each of them employs their area of expertise in a way that affects each of the two major defects of cystic fibrosis: delivering the protein to the cell surface and making it do its job once it's there. This drug was called Orkambi. Okay, hope is starting to creep in. Sort of like how I used to sneak into R-rated movies as a teenager. For myself and thousands of CF patients with the F508del mutation, this was a big deal. But the news of Orkambi didn't rock the CF world the same way that Kalydeco did, because it was too flawed. It did the two major jobs we needed it to do, but it didn't do them very well. Like those apathetic teens that work at the movie theater, present but not exactly passionate about their job. Sure, I mean, you know, they worked there and they had a job, but could they really stop me from sneaking into movies I wasn't supposed to see? And did they even care? Orkambi was only deemed moderately effective, and it was astronomically expensive, so most drug plans declined to fund it. Then the game changer arrived, because as we know, all good things come in threes. Vertex, learning from Orkambi, developed a new molecular trio: Ivacaftor, Kalydeco, Alexacaftor, and Tezacaftor. Together, they took on CF with the intensity of Jules, Vincent, and Mia from Pulp Fiction. It was like stepping into a Tarantino film, except this time I didn't have to sneak through the back door of the cinema. Okay, sorry, no more movie references. This game-changing drug, as we alluded to at the end of our first episode, was called Trikafta. And it's the latest in a succession of pharmaceutical developments spanning the past 20 years, and really beginning with the start of our story in 1989 with the discovery of the CFTR gene at SickKids in Toronto. It's a drug that, for the first time in my life, has made the feeling of hope accessible, worthwhile, and most importantly, real.
Life expectancy values for people who have access to Trikafta now, we expect that those estimates that we had are going to be completely wrong. We don't know exactly what they're going to look like. Some analyses have said that Trikafta is going to add at least 10 years to a person's life expectancy, but it could be more. This is still very early data.
Can you describe the process that's happening from like the moment that the pill goes into someone's mouth to the point where it starts to take effect on the protein? What's going on there?
Well, I can tell you what's happening sort of scientifically, but I have no idea what it's like to live through the experience. And so I think that that's amazing to hear about from CF patients, and it's always fascinating. So what happens when you start taking the medicine? It's in pill form, as you know. It goes through into your system. It passes into the blood. It spreads out through all areas of the body. It reaches your lung cells and it reaches other cells at the same time. But that initial sort of impact is largely around the lungs.
It felt as if I was changing in real time. Literally, from the moment I swallowed the first pill. And in a lot of ways, I was. Within just 2 days, I was a different person. The mucus that had filled my lungs for 33 years, causing me to cough uncontrollably, scarring my lungs, and edging me closer and closer to a lung transplant, was gone. The pancreatic problems that left me chronically malnourished for decades suddenly disappeared, allowing me to actually absorb nutrients and feel a level of energy that I've never experienced before. But it also threw me a curveball, one that I honestly could never have seen coming. What Trikafta does for me is it makes me a lot more like you.
It makes the date of my death a mystery. And for someone who spent their whole life contemplating and becoming comfortable with the idea of dying, and having a pretty good idea of when that might happen, it's weirdly unsettling. For me, the most unexpected side effect of Trikafta isn't physical. It's psychological. It's the fact that one of the things that made me the most me is gone. And the clarity I once had around my future, or lack thereof, I suppose, has dissipated. It's been replaced by confusion around what I want, what I need, and who I am in the absence of one of my most defining characteristics, my clarity of death. If you're listening to this and you've never walked in the shoes of a fatal chronic illness, it might seem like I'm complaining about not dying, which I guess I sort of am, but it's not that. It's that the thing that has underpinned every facet of my life is now gone. The floor has shifted beneath my feet, and I don't know where to step next. It's a problem I need to solve, and I don't know if I can really solve it on my own. There are so many things that have changed since getting access to this life-saving treatment. I need to talk to other people who have gone through what I've gone through, who understand the obstacles of planning for a future that doesn't exist, until all of a sudden, it does. Thank you for listening to Breathless, a podcast from Cystic Fibrosis Canada and Snack Labs. Breathless is hosted by me, Jeremy Saunders. It is edited by myself and Taylor McGilvery. Breathless is written by Taylor McGilvery, with sound design and original music by Donovan Morgan. Original music is also provided by Tom Fox. For more information on cystic fibrosis, visit www.cysticfibrosis.ca.